Mini episode 679 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by that NBA lottery pick, your pop culture influenced look at the world of hoops. Follow them on the web at that NBALotteryPick.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the FDH Lounge. History of the Royal Rumble series. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross, your historians, walking you through it here. Your wrestling historians.
Is that what we are?
It kind of, yeah. And going through year by year, I'm going to refer everybody, as I always do, at the outset of one of these individual years. If you want to hear thoughts on the thing thematically, the way that it kind of set up over history, structure of the Royal Rumble, whatever, 1988, 1A, that's where we started. We devote about 10, 15 minutes to it. We don't do that on the rest of them. We just kind of get right into it. 2005, this is one here that is in the era of split happens. So this is following up from 2003, 2004. We're now getting into the meat of this here now, Kyle Ross, of really building to the heart of when the split really meant something, because these 03 to 07 years are really pretty much it.
Yeah, and I would say, for all of its faults, that the first half of 2005 was the one time frame during this five-year period where the split most worked.
Mm-hmm.
In the framework of split happens, like we're calling it, this is part five, right?
That's
correct,
right.
Me if I'm wrong.
Yeah,
part
five.
This is 5C we're on. I always get confused with that. A lot of numbers and letters to start
That's
things
right.
off. Okay. So in the framework of split happens, when I watch the 2005 Royal Rumble, as I rewatched, I'd seen it many times before, but I rewatched it, and I look back to the previous year. We talked about in 04, kind of there was a real need to create some new stars, shake things up on top. They go with Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, mm-hmm. which, you know, was great for a lot of us at the time.
Right.
But even the biggest optimist, I think, knew that was a temporary thing.
That's right.
That was, you know, both guys had been around for a while. I mean, they weren't young.
Right.
And when I watched this show in 2005, I view it as the company's attempt to find a permanent fix to that long-standing problem of a need to create stars. I mean, right? That was one of the main things that they sold us on when they split the rosters. Oh, mm-hmm. well, this will give more guys a chance to shine because
right.
it's not going to just be the same three on top. Well, arguably, it kind of was for a
right.
while. There hadn't been a lot of ascension in 03 or 04. It did allow Benoit and Guerrero again, but again, that was temporary.
Right.
And by the time 05 was around, they had kind of sort of slid back down into their normal, up into their, as per usual,
right.
upper mid-card status. So you have Batista and Cena.
Mm-hmm.
This is a kind of a dual ascent they had to the top. And with this show, it's much more Batista.
It is. It is. And it's more pronounced, and it's because he's going to win the match here. Spoiler
yeah.
alert. But as I said to you off air, because of the split now being dead and buried, and I don't think it's coming back, but you never know. But until the split comes back, there will never be a card ever like this again, of where you are trying to elevate two guys at the same time, one to anchor either brand. In the meantime, the only thing you'll ever see would be sort of the equivalent of WrestleMania 1 with a Hogan and a Piper, but that would be a face and a heel to go up against one another in the main event, as opposed to individual face anchors on your two brands. With one brand, you'll never see that again.
Correct, because there's no need to do that.
That's
I mean,
right.
You know, now, you just build around one guy. I mean, that's the way the promotion
that's
always
right.
kind of was. You just build around one baby face when you had, theoretically,
yep.
you weren't building around just one guy here.
Right.
Two brands.
Right.
They were to be treated separate but equal. although
it worked as well as it did with the American political system here. Separate people.
Yeah, I was going to say the one criticism, the major criticism I would have of the brand split as we rolled into 2005 is that it was quite clear that SmackDown had become a secondary brand.
Does that make Royal Rumble 06 the Plessy v. Ferguson of the WWE era? You're thinking about that one.
Very good. But, you know, I mean, there was a void there. You know, with SmackDown sticking, obviously we'll talk about this when we get to his match, but JBL was a horrible champion.
Right.
And that really sunk SmackDown. A lot of people, I know I was among them, sort of just tuned that brand out largely for the year. And to be honest with you, I think I made mention of this in the last mini episode. It was sort of a lackluster second half of 04, much like it was a lackluster second half of 03. I had kind of just sort of, you know, I was working at the time, I was a park manager at Swings and Things. I think I was working a lot of Monday nights. This was pre-DVR. And I was missing Raw a lot, and I didn't feel like I was missing much. But I remember being ready for this show. It's a very good show.
Mm-hmm.
No, not an all-time great show, but what struck me is the logical booking. They knew where they were going
right here.
All the backstage stuff was really good, you know, which it never is. Usually it's either a waste of time or unfunny or something like that, but they had a direction, and they went with it, and overall, I really like this show.
I'm going to go a step further, because this is a thought that just occurred to me. When you're talking about comparing the fall of 04 to the fall of 03, that's a very much a modern characteristic of, OMG, it's football season, time for them to suck, because they're going up against Monday Night Football, and nothing's going to stick this fall, and they pretty much that's the time of year that's the Dead Sea area. But it's interesting because that didn't used to be the case. You go back to the 90s, even before wrestling got hot again. Think about the fall of 96 with Bret Hart coming back and with Austin, the fall of 97 with all the stuff that was going on there. Like, this is something that really just kind of started in these years and took root. I don't know that every fall since then has sucked, but it's a tendency that really started then, and it's probably happened more years than not ever since then.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's a case like, well, we're just going to wait till WrestleMania or what it is. I mean, they did try something, and this is something we'll get to as well, is the Randy Orton face turn and what a colossal failure that was. And sort of the blink and you'll miss it nature of that, I think kind of killed the fall.
Yeah.
And again, with SmackDown, JBL was such an, you know, there's a difference between being an effective heel and then there's like that old, you know, what the
go
term,
away
X-Pac
heat.
Heat. Where people are like, you know, no, it's not, we're not booing you because you're an effective heel. We're booing you because we don't want to see you on the screen.
It's a great gimmick, but he was hot-shotted to the top way too quick. He was not a main event level worker. The matches were just not good. I mean, the irony is that
one of the matches with Eddie was okay, I remember. It was the one that went to a non-finish. The first one was really bloody.
Oh, good match with Eddie in it. You don't say.
Yeah, well, I'm not defending. I'm just saying that, like,
right.
You're right. Coming off what we'd expected from the previous, at that point, like 4 years of main events, 4, 5, 6 years of WWE main events. JBL was not up to that standard. And they tried a lot of bells and whistles with them, too. A lot of interference.
Right.
A lot of gimmick matches, and none of them were memorable or particularly good.
Here's something I'd like to get to ask him if he's ever on the show. We've had a lot of people from the wrestling world on the show. A question I'd like, because he seems like off-air, he's certainly more introspective than you might think, intellectually honest, whatever, is that if he would agree with the notion that he had a main event gimmick as a heel, but he was a much better worker as a face, but he wasn't a main event guy because he had that blue-collar kick-ass thing. The crowd was behind him. He had the spots that really excited the crowd as a face, as the beer-drinking ass-kicker, but he wasn't a main event guy. It was sort of like an Austin ripoff, but he was much more entertaining to watch as a face.
And not to come to his defense, but I will say that he was not the original plan for SmackDown. The original plan for SmackDown in 04 was Triple H to go over and work with Eddie. Triple H balked at that. Eddie was kind of imploding personally, and they needed to take the title off him, and JBL just kind of happened to be right guy, right time. They didn't have anyone else to do it.
Because Angle's neck was still the old stack of dimes. He had to take time off again. And,
I kind of have an idea that I'll share later when we get to the title matches.
The great ego F of that 3-for-1 trade, though. Booker T and the Dudleys coming over. I'll maintain this, though. We were talking off air, like, who could it have been? They immediately turned Booker T heel anyways. Booker T at that point would have been more credible coming over there because, you know, say what you will, he'd at least been on top before, albeit in WCW.
Yeah, like I said, I have an idea what they could have done. I'll share it when we get to the title matches here. But overall, before we get into the match, I just want to say that aside from the fact that SmackDown was the B-show, I think starting to become the B-show here,
this
overall, we were starting to actually see the brand split working for different reasons. You know, it was kind of unique to have the Raw guys and the SmackDown guys together. You know, that was what it was supposed to be like.
Right.
We'll split the rosters, and then when they come together, it'll feel like a real big show.
Right.
This felt like a big deal. Interesting, this is the, I believe, first WWE pay-per-view ever that did not feature a single tag team match.
History. I did not realize that.
I read that somewhere when I was doing my research.
Yeah,
for the
show. It didn't. And here's the thing too, that you get a different feel watching these shows one after another than you did in real time. I will grant you one thing: watching these things one at a time as a representative of each year and where they were at, it does feel more like a real brand split than at the time. At the time, if you're just paying attention month to month. The whole thing of like, hey, it's the Royal Rumble, and the Raw and SmackDown guys are on it. Like, yawn. But they do, when you just watch these things as a moment in history, it does make it feel, I think, more like it felt at the time. I don't think watching it at the time it felt as special as it does looking back on it. I think this is our 2016
eyes. The other problem is that we talked about this when we did the mini episode in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
The brand-only pay-per-views sucked.
Yeah.
They started, but they largely all sucked. Like, what was your – name your favorite brand-only pay-per-view of all time. Name a good one. Name one that sticks out.
There isn't one.
No, they were all just – they were in your houses.
You know, it was probably the best one. I don't remember what they called it, but this is like a cheat. The second one in June of 2005.
Yes, that was a cheating
Cena
one.
And Batista on it because
yes.
It was before they moved Batista
to that.
Over.
No, and obviously that hasn't happened yet here in our timeline. But Vengeance
2005
was a loaded show right after One Night Stand. I think the WWE locker room kind of had seen what that pay-per-view was and got real motivated for that show. But they loaded it up with two title matches because that was the era and... Stay tuned, fans, because we're going to have a lot. I know at least going to have a lot to say about this when we get to 06. That was when Cena had been traded to Raw and Batista had not yet been traded to SmackDown. They blew off the Batista-Triple H feud.
That's right.
In a Hell in a Cell on that Vengeance show. And then Cena, that was his first Raw title defense.
That's right.
That was a loaded show. And they also had Angle had come over to Raw and had the WrestleMania rematch with Michaels. That was that's one of the best, like, non-big 4 pay-per-views ever.
Probably, yeah.
I'll say this, though. We talk about Batista and Triple H being blown off. We need to talk about that feud starting.
Right.
That feud was so well that I think...
It was.
And you see it here. There's a lot of subtlety in what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had a lot of arguments with people online about, you know, how great surprises are in wrestling. And I think they're overrated in movies and in wrestling. I'm not a huge surprise guy. I don't want to ever have a surprise party. So maybe that's just me. But you would have to be a pretty big rube not to know where this Batista Triple H thing was going,
right,
and how they were teasing this while watching this show. Yet, how great was it? Like,
it was.
You know, it all culminated in that great moment on Raw where Batista's choosing, again, spoiler alert, he wins the Rumble here.
Mm-hmm.
When he's choosing to, is he going to go challenge his quote unquote friend Triple H in Evolution, or is he going to go over to SmackDown and wrestle JBL? And he's looking at the two titles and. Remember, he's got the thumbs up thing.
Yep.
That is a top 10 Raw moment when, you know, he's like holding the thumbs up to Triple H. They're like, he's going to SmackDown. And then he does the thumbs down and he quits Evolution. That was really good. To me, I may have said it before on this program, that is the last great, and this is kind of frightening because it was over 10 years ago, money-drawing pro wrestling feud this company's done.
Probably,
it's
yeah.
It's not like, Rock and Cena is different. That was just bringing back a huge major name from the past. But as far as, like, doing a storyline with two active guys on your roster, I don't think they've done one this good since.
And here's the irony is that, again, we talk about in it, when you think of WrestleMania season 2005, which the Rumble starts, it goes to Mania, it will always be defined by the rise of Batista, the rise of Cena.
It's more so Batista, and that becomes really important later in the year when they switch him.
And that's kind of the point I was going to make, because, but here's the thing. The Cena thing, you could see this for a long time. And I don't think it's just revisionist history now, when they say him getting the U.S. title off the Big Show at WrestleMania 20, that was the beginning. Like, with Cena, it was like a one-year build to the top. Versus on the other side, Orton was originally the guy. In the summer of 04, I'm reading the dirt sheets, and I'm going, there's no way that your most unlikable character in the company is going to make it as a face. I mean, I knew immediately that thing was going to be a disaster. Sometimes I've been wrong, but I was right about that one. My point about all this is, Batista, you're right. He was more the focus of this show. He was the one that main evented WrestleMania 20, and yet, compared to the 21. Real 21, as opposed to the real long-term build with Cena, this was more impromptu. This was somewhere around the fall to winter and everything, but I'll tell you what,
and
though.
He saved him. He bailed him out. He bailed him out for that stupid Orton face turn, how they botched that.
Right.
And he was the focus of the promotion, and it makes you wonder if how they kind of forced Cena past him when they switched. Because that's what they did, really.
Right.
That's what it was about. When they switched the brands on them.
Right.
When Cena goes to Raw and Batista goes to SmackDown. That was WWE blatantly, in my opinion, saying, well, Cena's the number one guy.
Sure.
And that was in spite of the fact that Batista did a hell of a job in his role. And look, Cena should have been long-term the guy. He was younger, and I think he had more legs and was more versatile. Because Batista, truth be told, outside of this feud, you know, a lot of it, you could take it or leave it. But I think there was a lot of resentment from the fans down the stretch. And you didn't see that here, by the way. Cena was, again, for a second straight year, we talked about this in 04, was super over as a ascending babyface.
But he hadn't really pussified his character yet either. So.
True, but I always think, and I'll talk about that in 06.
That's one of the great bait and switches of all time, is him going to the Marine salute thing.
Never give
that's
up.
That's not what got him over.
No. But
total bait and switch.
I always think that there was a little resentment from the fans who...
It was probably part of it.
Who Batista was clearly the 1A babyface and Cena 1B, but WWE's like, well, no, Cena's 1A now.
Here's the thing, too, though, and this bears drawing out a little bit. I know you're a guy that pays attention to these kinds of subtleties and everything. I think back to Royal Rumble 04, the match that Batista had with Flair against the Dudleys. And, yeah, I mean, they squashed the Dudleys to get Flair and Batista over. But on that show, Batista was just a generic screaming muscle head. By 05, I mean, he's there. Every time he's on screen, he's the cool guy in the suit. Man, a few words, but they count. What I mean, like, they had figured out how to channel the inner cool of Dave Batista, because that was, like, peak Batista as far as a character, the early part of 05. 04 was, like, it might as well have been 10 years beforehand. They hadn't come close to figuring out Batista until that run.
It was shocking, and Triple H gets a lot of criticism. But that feud was kind of his baby. He was the one who convinced them to do this long, slow build.
Yeah.
That, you know, and they don't do that very often.
Right.
I mean, there were issues. I think these issues kind of started all the way, like, in the middle of the fall of 04.
Right. It was a nice slow build.
It was a real slow, where it kept being subtle and, like, oh, you know, they'd take jabs at each other. And Triple H would kind of start subtly mistreating Batista. And Batista, he just got it. Like, he just... To his credit, and to your point, where he was kind of like, he was really the fourth wheel in Evolution in early 04. But to his credit, you know, he really picked it up, man. And he got the ball, and he ran with it, as Vince McMahon would say. But
he really, really did. And the last point I want to make before we get into this, like I said to you off air, as far as Batista and Cena, it's one of these things where you know that Vince always has certain dates, certain years that he's pointing towards. WrestleMania 10, 20, 30, even 32, because it's going to be, you know, in Jerry world here, a couple months out from when we're doing this. So, in a sense, he's getting what he wants with Roman Reigns' coronation, presumably, in that spot. He's not getting what he wants in terms of a loaded card because everybody's hurt. So, it's not. But it's always a matter of, does the timing line up with the aspiration? And it's WrestleMania 21, not 20, that launches this new era. And Vince, in his heart of hearts, probably would have wished that this would have been either WrestleMania 20, WrestleMania 25, whatever. It just so happens WrestleMania 21 happens to be the year that launches probably the two defining guys of the next 5 years or so. I mean, Orton's in there as well, if you're looking at the young guys getting launched. Two of the top three guys of the next 5 years who weren't already established.
That's a good point you made about, like, a new era.
Mm-hmm.
Because this really, although it's still part of this, you know, split happens part five thing that we're doing.
Right.
To me, this is a clear turning point in the company where,
yes,
sort of the last vestiges of the Attitude Era,
yeah,
are no longer on top.
Yeah, because I always look at, like,
you know, it's the crew that's been elevated is a post-Monday Night Wars,
right,
group.
To me, like, 02 and 03 are like transitional years of where there's still vestiges. 04 is just a weird year that I've never known what to make of because, as you say, Benoit and Guerrero were like interim choices to be on top. Neither one of which, and as you said off air, and you pointed out, Bret Hart at 10, those guys at 20, Daniel Bryan at 30. It's interesting that the years that, like, you know, Vince McMahon wants to crown the guy for the next 10 years, every time.
Those are like his most unlikely champions he's ever had.
It's like, okay, I'll push this guy because I have to. So it's just the timing of it is something I find funny, that WrestleMania 21 as opposed to 20 ends up being what would stick as a launching pad, especially in the career of Cena, although also Batista, who, again, takes the lead here, as you said.
Shall we talk about the individual matches on this card?
We shall.
Okay.
It was an interesting one.
Yeah.
Undercard not as good as the main event, certainly.
No, but, again, there was logical booking throughout. Like, a lot of shows, you're like, oh, this guy should have gone over. That was wrong. I don't begrudge any of the booking on this show whatsoever. So
me neither.
Each brand got a world title match and a grudge match underneath. The Raw grudge match, which opens up the show, is Edge versus Shawn Michaels, which is kind of a forgotten feud, is
uh-huh.
it not? This one started at Taboo Tuesday. Remember that? We added a few new pay-per-views in 2004 on the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
That was a failed concept, by the way, Taboo Tuesday.
That's right.
That was when the fans got to pick the matches,
much
theoretically.
Like New Year's Revolution.
Which was also added, had just happened before
right.
This show, the Rumble. But both shows going to Raw, the new shows.
Yeah.
So we saw a shifting then when SmackDown got, what, Armageddon is the was the December one.
That's right.
And then No Way Out, the February one.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so a feud started here. Edge, and by the way, Edge is a name that, you know, it's been a little bit since we've talked about him because he got hurt early 03, missed that whole year, came back in the middle of 04 as a babyface. They had big plans for him as a babyface, but
right.
he didn't get over as a babyface. Remember, he was supposed to work with Triple H.
Right.
And, you know, he even mentioned it in his DVD. I think it was the Decade of Decadence one,
mm-hmm.
ripping off Motley Crue's Greatest Hits album name right there, where Bizarro World Toronto, that SummerSlam,
mm-hmm.
which was his hometown, the fans booed him.
Yeah.
And
yeah, Never Gonna Stop Me, Edge, was not as over as On This Day I See Clearly, Edge.
Or, you know, or Never Gonna Stop Me, I'll Do Your Girlfriend, Edge.
Yeah.
I think. And that hadn't happened yet.
Right.
By the way, the whole debacle with Matt Hardy and Lita backstage. But
right.
Edge clearly had hit a ceiling as a babyface. And he was an okay babyface, but he was not going to be a main event babyface.
Here's a funny thing, though. They were a couple of years in the making of investing in this guy. Because here's the thing. Go back to the summer of 2002. Who's the guy who shaved Kurt Angle?
Oh, no,
Edge.
No, it worked. They built him. He was sort of the breakout star on SmackDown. He benefited from the
yeah.
brand split in 2002.
Right.
But I think the fact that we're only talking about him hitting his ceiling now was a result of injury. Like,
right.
it would have happened regardless. It would have just happened earlier.
It was kind of a flat
had he
return.
Never got hurt.
Yeah.
But he was good. I mean, it wasn't like he was doing anything wrong. I just think that he was missing something, and this heel turn served him well. So it started at Taboo Tuesday, if I can get back to that.
Sure.
Where he was mad the fans chose Shawn Michaels to challenge Triple H and not him. Mm-hmm. And I thought, to be honest with you, as failed a concept as Taboo Tuesday was, mm-hmm. that was kind of a nice little way to use that pay-per-view to do something and
Absolutely.
Build out of it. You know? So I don't begrudge it. Now, this match itself is pretty good. When you see Edge versus Shawn Michaels, you probably have pretty high expectations.
Right.
And if you do, I'd ask you to guard him for this match because it's not awesome. I think
not the sum of its parts.
It's like a 3 3/4 star match, though. Mm-hmm. I think it's like it would be a good Raw main event. But again, here, it wasn't asked to carry the show. It was the opener.
Right. Also, I have in my notes from watching that match, Lawler inexplicably back to now being a heel commentator. When you're watching from year to year, it's just like, oh, what's Lawler this time?
He kind of was. You know, yeah. Still, which was better. But anyway, I was going to say this. The feud, as much as I kind of liked it on paper, they didn't have great chemistry, I feel. There was,
right.
We did get in this match an old-school Shawn Michaels tongue-lashing on
right.
Edge for being out of position. Goes over, though, which
right.
is the right call. He wins with, you know, a roll-up and holding the tights. But
I mean, this wasn't Waller-Piper for, you know, a clash of styles. I mean that's
no,
the all-time
that,
worst.
No, it was okay, but like...
But you're right. They didn't mesh as well as you would think.
It didn't feel like... Elevate, you know, we talk about elevation with Batista and Cena. Even though Edge goes over here, this did not feel like a massive elevation for Edge. His elevation really came a couple months down the road, wins Money in the Bank,
yeah.
starts doing Lita, you know, gets paired with Lita on the screen. That was when he started really drawing kind of that main event level heat.
That's a good point. And also, too, looking at him like in the fall of 2004, before we go awarding the Nobel Prize for booking to them for turning him heel, all you got to do is look at the guy at that stage and think to yourself, well, when's the last time he was really interesting? Edge and Christian era Edge. We'd seen him do it before with the heel charisma. All he had to do was go back to that, use it in a different way.
They always, from when they brought him into the company, I feel, they always envisioned him kind of as that white meat baby face.
They kind of did.
They
that's
always
how he
kind of,
started.
That's kind of how they always
Sexton
had that plan. You know, I don't know, he was kind
you
know. Of, you know,
I mean,
they look
didn't
at
call
him,
that,
good-looking guy,
right.
I guess, you know, a lot of teeth. You know, a lot of hair, a lot
right.
of things they liked. But, again, he wound
kind
up...
Kind of an unnerving amount of teeth.
I don't know. He, to me, when you look back at Edge's career as a whole, much better as a heel than as a face. He
Absolutely.
Wasn't a bad face, but he was a great heel. There was a, by the way, in the crowd, I noticed this during this match, a Macho We Need You sign shown on very clearly on the hard camera. Just wanted
okay.
to throw that in there.
All right.
Just throw it in there. I referenced that
there wasn't anybody's daughter holding that sign up, was it?
Jesus.
I'm not going to get more explicit than that.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I referenced earlier that there were some really good backstage segments during the show, building up the Rumble. We had we did have Eddie in this one, but it was Eric Bischoff and Teddy Long, the two GMs. Teddy Long, we should... We welcome him to the program here mm-hmm. as the SmackDown general manager. By the way, that kind of reinforces them as the B brand, didn't it?
Pretty
I
much.
I always thought, you know, God bless Teddy Long's soul. He tried and did the best he could. I thought him being the GM was such an uninspired choice.
A guy for
time.
Like,
especially he lasted so long.
Yeah,
and like, it felt like they never wanted him. Like Vince would always like show up and be like, you know, Teddy, I might just fire you, and like that did nothing.
And
to
like
him.
Every show for 7 consecutive years. That they did was set up with opening segment, guys clashing with each other, other guys come out, Teddy Long comes out, play a main event. Every show for 7 years was the same way.
Yeah. Well,
you know, what are you going to do?
This was so they had Bischoff. Again, this was kind of reinforcing the brand split. They had the two GMs arguing. And this first sort of storyline they started doing backstage was Eddie Guerrero and Ric Flair drawing their numbers.
Right.
They don't tell you what numbers they draw,
mm-hmm.
but. You know, it's becomes obvious that Flair's very happy with his number. Oh, by the way, he winds up being 30. Eddie's very upset. Oh, by the way, he's number 1 or is he 2? I can't remember. He's 1 or 2, he gets.
Yeah.
But Eddie does the thing where he steals Flair's number. They hug Eddie. He's like, oh, best of luck to you, Rick. You know, I'll see you out there. And he hugs him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rick shows the number to the women. Because they also would have, like, Tori and somebody else were, like, running the Rumble drawing
was
thing.
It Candice Michelle was one of them? I don't
that
even...
was 06 she
okay.
was in. But anyway,
right.
By the way, I like when they draw the numbers, by the way. They used to be a good old school thing. But anyway, Flair shows them the number. It's a terrible number. They're like, why are you so excited about that? And he's like, Guerrero stole my number. So I thought that was pretty
cool. By the way, and I have in my notes here, Benoit 1, Guerrero 2, they were playing off the year before. That's where they were in the Rumble. Yes.
You're
questioning me with your facial look here, but no, they were 1-2 in the Rumble.
Yeah,
so
I know
Eddie
that.
Eddie had 2. So you were saying, I don't know if it's 1 or 2.
Oh, okay. I didn't know why they were playing off the year before, though. I know Benoit was...
Well, because they both won the year before. So
okay, I got you. You meant playing off the Rumble.
I meant WrestleMania.
Okay.
But okay.
So anyway, that was an effective segment. I'll tell you what was not that effective was, you know, your When John Meets Gene... sketch we got.
That's almost like it's so bad it's good funny.
Yeah, it
kind of borderline.
And what was funny is, again, I mentioned that I hadn't watched that much in 2004. I guess they had actually done one of these before Survivor Series, which was in Cleveland. Ironically, the show was in Cleveland. I've never even seen it.
I was there. It was crap.
Okay, the show was, or the segment?
The show, the segment, whatever, was just utter shite.
Okay.
I was there.
Well, apparently they had done one of these before.
By the way, thank you, Ron Glasnow, for the free tickets, but it was still shite. You know it.
They had done one of these Heidenreich-Snitsky meetups before.
Right.
And you're right. It is so cheesy that, like, wasn't
it like...
I'm just
thinking in the parlance of the era, what would a Heidenreich-Snitsky meetup be like?
Yeah. Well, no, because wasn't it like, you know, Snitsky's like... I like your poetry, John. And John's like, I like what you do with babies, Gene.
Yeah.
Like, it was so preposterous that you're right. It actually was almost like, you know, you almost kind of like it in that ironic way.
But here's the funny thing, though. It's like, it's that, but it's the kind of thing where if you're watching with non-wrestling fans, you're just embarrassed to be alive.
Yeah, kind of.
Pretty much.
Yes, kind of. So anyway, this was, again, and that was a Raw and SmackDown guy. Now, it wasn't exactly,
right.
You know, wasn't exactly, you know, Batista meeting up with John Cena backstage, but it did lead into our next match, which was the SmackDown grudge match, a casket match between Undertaker versus Heidenreich.
Right.
Now, I told the listeners that if you have these really high expectations for Edge Michaels in the opener, you might be a little let down.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of like the inverse of it, where I went in thinking that this would be like a worst match of the year contender and was just kind of like, yeah, you know, that was just a bad match, but it wasn't horrible. And
my notes just say, okay, simply enough.
It did get over to some degree. Now, the original plan for WrestleMania 21 with The Undertaker was he and Kane against Heidenreich and Snitsky. I believe he 86 that.
Okay.
Personally. And then he winds up working against Orton, who had freshly turned heel after the failed face run that we'll get into in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest with you, after watching this match, because Orton losing in that at WrestleMania to Undertaker did him no favors, I would have rather them just do this tag match, as terrible as it might seem on paper, because it kind of got over. So they do the thing where Snitsky comes down, interferes, helps Heidenreich, you know, because it's no DQ, it's a casket match.
Mm-hmm.
We should mention this was set up by Heidenreich costing Undertaker a couple matches, world title matches, at some previous pay-per-views.
That's right, yeah,
the
against
SmackDown
JBL.
Only pay-per-views. I want to say, yeah, against JBL, I want to say it was No Mercy and Armageddon, I think he costed
right.
matches at or
yeah.
something. So Kane comes out of the casket randomly.
Right.
And the crowd popped kind of big for it. It was not roll your eyes. And when I'm watching those four brawl, I'm like, you know, I would rather have just them done that tag match than have Undertaker beat Randy Orton at WrestleMania.
The funny thing is, when you look at predictability, particularly in this era, it was predictable every year that Undertaker would win at WrestleMania. But it's so weird the pattern they got into with him in terms of other times of the year. 02 and 03 in the fall, he's dumping to Lesnar. 04, he's dumping to JBL. 05, he's dumping to Orton. So it's like, it's kind of funny that it gets to later in the year, and it's just like, boy, this is going to be the opposite. He's going down to somebody.
Well, remember, at this point, the streak was noted, obviously.
In
it
its
was
infancy
a big thing,
of
but
really being
it wasn't
played up.
WrestleMania was not being built around the streak really in any way. At this point.
Was Orton the first one to target it, like, as a trophy, I think, in 05?
Yeah, because he went back to being the legend killer. It kind of was. And I remember at the time really thinking he should have gone over in that, especially after he had just turned heel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, losing in that did him no favors.
In fairness, and there's times I thought he should have lost. I certainly thought he should have lost in 07 to Batista. But I'll tell you this. In fairness to me and you, we had no way of seeing into the future how much they were going to be able to milk that with him against other legends.
No, in retrospect, you're right. It's a good idea that they didn't. The streak obviously got to the point where it was always kind of the number two thing at WrestleMania. In some instances, it was the number one thing.
Right.
So anyway, Undertaker wins this. No surprise. John Heidenreich, we should point this out, that a one-year wonder, kind of. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the only Rumble I think he's ever... Well, I shouldn't say that. He kind of hung around, didn't he? I wouldn't be surprised if he should. I know he wasn't in at all in 06.
Right.
But he hung on for a little bit after this,
well,
I think.
Well, and it's funny, too, because I talked about this a little bit earlier in this Part 5 series of what you would see in this era.
Yeah, that's why
the
I brought
interchangeable
that up.
Muscle heads. Yeah, what, you know, last year maybe it was Luther Reigns or whatever. I mean, it was just – that's part of the reason there's a lost generation there, is all these muscle heads that they pushed for no good reason, Snitsky among them.
Yeah, I want to look up to see if Heidenreich ever appeared. Because he did. Because remember he, like, started teaming with Road Warrior Animal?
That's right. Spring of 06. The new Road Warriors. That's making me long for the days of pre-paralyzed draws in the Road Warriors, I'll tell you.
John Heidenreich. Oh, Jesus. John Heidenreich. Let's take a look at his Wikipedia page and see if he ever... Did he, like, make it to the 07 Rumble? Because truth be told, I have not watched any here for the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Announced. No, in January of 06, they announced he had been released from his contract. So, yeah, he really was a one-year wonder. He was basically around from the, well, a little bit more. He was around from the fall of 04 all the way through 05. But,
Was the animal stuff in 05 then? I was thinking it was 06. Okay, my
yeah,
bad.
Yeah, well,
all right.
Well, we are, regardless, I mean, I see, you know, okay. I'm looking at his page on time.
Does it even matter? Yeah.
On October 28th of 2005, the Road Warriors, air quotes, lost the tag team championship to Eminem in a match that also involved the Mexicools and William Regal and Paul Burchill. Oh, five.
Yeah, that's a sentence you wouldn't have seen back in 1987, ladies and gentlemen. All of those jabrones. Aside from the great William Regal, of course.
Yes. So, again, though, you know, I didn't hate this as much as, you know, you see this, you're like, oh, God, I bet you this is going to be bad. Another horrible Undertaker cast. Imagine it's not good, but if you go in with terrible expectations, you won't hate it,
right.
I guess. So
keep them low, ladies and gentlemen.
And you know, again, things seemed logical. It seemed like they had a direction. Had they gone with that tag match?
That's right.
You know, it seemed that they had some logical booking going on here. More good backstage stuff on this program with the teased tension between Triple H and Batista. So, going back to that Rick Eddie thing, you know, the Evolution was mad that Guerrero stole Flair's number. They get it back. Of course, Triple H had to get off the give it back to him, you jumping bean, which I thought was unnecessary, to say the least. But anyway, so they get Flair gets the number back, and Triple H is like, hey, we need to go over some strategy for this Orton match.
Mm-hmm.
And Batista's like, no, I want to get my number. And a lot of times it's just like, yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It really worked.
It did.
Because it kept teasing the tension. So again, bravo to them, I mean, with the slow burn.
Yeah.
We also then, backstage, again, usually these backstage gets unfunny, waste of time. I thought all of them were good here. And back in the Rumble drawing room with Eddie and Teddy, or pardon me, I keep saying Eddie, Eric and Teddy.
Eric and Teddy.
I guess that's why. Yeah. You know, Eric, Teddy, you can get
that's
Eddie
right.
out of that. We got the Christian John Cena freestyle battle.
Right.
And this was outstanding. I'll never forget, because, you know, obviously this kind of led to a match down the road when Cena comes back to Raw, but this was kind of their first meetup, and Cena's like, Christian's like, oh, it's the big John Cena, and he kind of teased his tension. Again, a Raw and SmackDown guy at the time. That's kind of working. And Cena wanted to, he's like, oh, I'm a good, Christian. I'm screwing up my names left and right here. Christian wanted to rap. And he's like, Tomko, give me a beat. Tomko's like, no. I loved that. I absolutely loved that.
Yeah.
And again, Cena was not the PG white meat babyface that he'd become at this point. So.
Right.
You know,
why they got him away from this? Ugh, I'll never know.
I don't know, but yeah. So that was good. So now we get to the title matches, and I want to talk about these title matches here.
Okay.
Because I think they were both worked okay. But they both kind of had a certain stink about them that did not allow me to enjoy them fully.
Okay.
With SmackDown, we had a three-way JBL, Big Show, and Angle. I don't remember really how this was set up. All I know is that it was another JBL title match.
Yep.
And I think at this point in your mind, like, well, a JBL title match can only be so good. And again, they had a lot of bells and whistles in this, a lot of interference. Angle was in this tweener role. Apparently, he wrestled Santa Claus at Armageddon.
Ugh. And not the Santa Claus that ended up being, who was it, Savio Vega or whoever that was?
It was actually Balls Mahoney.
Balls Mahoney, that's right.
Yeah, no,
because right.
he attacked Savio Vega, and I'll never forget Vince McMahon's calling of it. That can't be the real Santa Claus. That was a real nadir for the WWF.
By the way, as far as this title match goes, flip that coin, ladies and gentlemen. Heads, okay, Big Show is a face this year.
Yeah.